So, after potentially a minor hiccup to get started, let's start over. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. And this is what happens when you try to do it live from a lab after 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Anyway, I've got Andy Klein from Backblaze with me today. He's the cloud storage storyteller over at Backblaze, and we're going to get a handle on that and how good his stories are here in a second. But Andy is one of the guys behind the quarterly storage report that Backblaze puts together. I know home labbers love it to see the data from all those glorious hard drives and a couple SSDs that that they have in the ecosystem there. In terms of the data that gets put out there into the industry about annual failure rates, Backblaze is one of the best in being open and communicative about that. Now, they don't always use necessarily data center product, and we'll talk about all that, I'm sure. But Andy, that's a pretty big run-up and some technical difficulties, but thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate being here. Looking forward to it.
Well, yeah, you say that now, but wait till our Discord gets through with you. So we've invited a bunch of people from our Discord to join in live on the on YouTube and ask their comments, and I've promised that if one of them makes me proud, that I will send them a box of goodies, which could include stuff on this table. We don't know yet. The odds of them impressing me are kind of low, but we'll see. I'm going to keep an open mind. So your study, your Q1 study, just came out in the last couple of days. You are indexing like 300,000 hard drives at this point. Give a high level of what that looks like and why that's important to Backblaze.
Well, it's important to us for two things. One, I think it's part of our DNA to be transparent about what we can and what we do. Okay. And when we started DriveStats doing back in 2015 or so, that was kind of the reason. We had done some other things before that. Talked about our storage servers or storage pods and how we built them and so on and so forth, and open source the design of all of that. We talked about our experiences doing something called drive farming, which was what happened when they had the floods in Thailand and it shut down production of about half the world's hard drives. We've talked about going through we almost got acquired back in 2011. We walked through that with folks. So DriveStats was initially just another way of communicating about the things we do internally and saying, hey, this is how it works in here. That's the number one objective. The other one is it's kind of fun. It's information that's not out there in much. Hopefully it helps people gain insights into us, gain insights into the drives that they're using, and give them something that they can't get anywhere else.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in terms of organizations that provide failure rate information, there's none that I'm aware of that's bigger than you or even close to you guys. Is anyone else being this open with this kind of data other than what they report back to WD, Seagate, Toshiba, et cetera?
You know, we see from time to time something surfaces, like we did part of this last one. We talked a little bit about the storage review folks, and they do data, some analysis on the drives that they collect and had gotten back and failed. And so it's always good to see that kind of information, make it out there. The other side of why we do this too is it's from an operational point of view. It's great information internally to understand. I mean, we really work hard to understand our environment inside because we have to optimize the way our environment works. I don't want to go into products and all of that kind of stuff, but, you know, we're on the lower end of the price spectrum, if you will, for what we charge for our services. And so there's only so many ways you can do that. And one of them is to be incredibly efficient about what you do. And so that's what we try to do from an operational point of view. And this data is part of all of that.
Well, talk a little bit about that operational efficiency. I know you've retired some drives, and we'll talk about that a little bit when they get to too small of a sample size, it looks like. But you still have a ton of, looks like 16,000 or so 4-terabyte drives and another, I don't know, about 20,000 8 terabyte drives. How long can a small hard drive like that be efficient in your system when you know that we're sitting out there with 24s and now with Hammer, 30 plus out there? How do those little ones stay relevant to you, or why do they stay relevant to your operation?
Well, they stay relevant because, one, they continue to function. Okay. And so I don't.
So being alive is a good
being alive is a good thing. But they continue to function at a rate of failure that's, I'll just say, below a threshold. And I don't want to put a number out there because every drive has a different one and the circumstances are different and what chassis they're in and so on and so forth. A lot of the 4 terabyte drives are in the 45 drive chassis. That we had way back when. And so now that we've gone past that and we're up to we're using 60 drives in a chassis, the amount of storage density you can get by upgrading to 16s or 20s or whatever is enormous. But you also need that price point. You also need those drives to be at the right price point in their curve. They all come down a little bit. They start out high, and over time, you start out something at 3, 4, 5 cents a terabyte.
Sure.
Gigabyte. And then they come down and you're paying a penny and a half, right? And so someplace you don't want to be at the top of the curve, you don't want to wait for the bottom. So when you start to do all of that math, having those drives function and fail at relatively low rates, and then picking the time to move them is the way we look at it. So if you can get a drive to last, in 6 or 7 years. Based on the life cycle of drives today. Now, if the manufacturers started doubling those rates, and so 2 years from now we have 50 terabyte drives, the math all changes.
Right.
But that hasn't been the case. It took the industry a long time to recover from the whole Thailand drive crisis mess. And really get back to innovation. There was a whole bunch of consolidation that happened. And, so I think finally they're starting to get their feet underneath them, but they're also running into just physical limitations of what you can cram onto, a spinning platter.
Well, yeah, for sure. We did a podcast with Seagate not long ago about Hammer technology. So if you guys are curious in terms of what's coming to enable higher density hard drives, that's a good one to check out. And for anyone that's playing along with this or even checking this pod out later, we've got linked in the description the Q1 24 failure report that I'm referencing we're talking about this evening or afternoon. So you can check that out and see what we're talking about in terms of drive coverage. So I asked you about the little ones, but you've got a bunch of 22s in there now from WD, and it looks like you guys sort of skated over the 18 and 20s. So is that all part of that mathematics that you were talking about, or your cost per terabyte?
Yeah, we got, and we continue to get, to be honest, really good prices on 16 terabytes. And the cost numbers kind of broke really well for the 22s. It doesn't mean that we won't have 18s or 20s in. It's just that right now the math doesn't work.
Right.
And we saw the same thing, like when they went from 4 to 6 and there was fives in there for about 15 minutes. So we got some fives and we put them in. And then what ends up happening is if you don't do it in bulk, you have a problem replacing them and so on and so forth. So kind of lessons learned a little bit.
Well, a lot of those fives, I don't know what era of five you're talking about, but I know a lot of the fives, those guys tried to sneak out there as SMR in branded products and others, and I use sneak sort of to make it sound more nefarious than it probably was, but I mean, that's got to matter to you guys when you're profiling these drives, if you end up with something that, we'll talk about procurement in a little bit, that maybe you don't expect or delivers a performance profile that's unexpected.
Yeah, we test them all. First of all, we don't use SMR drives, plain and simple.
Okay.
It doesn't work for the architecture, and it you pay a pretty good penalty to have to delete and rewrite.
Yep.
And that's the nature of the business here. We don't discourage people from trying to delete files. You can put a file out and delete it the next day, and you pay for one day, right? If that's going to be your model and that's the way you're going to work, then you can't use a technology underneath which penalizes you for that. So, So we don't use SMRs. That said, any drive that comes in the door, we have a testing protocol that we go through. And we run it in, we have what's called a mini vault, which is normally a vault is 20 servers hooked together, and a mini vault is 6. And all we're really doing there is putting the drives through their paces, and seeing how well they scale up, what happens when we fill them up, how's their performance, all of that. And a little bit about, you're only going to do this for like 3 months or so, so you're not going to get a lot of performance data, right. But sometimes you can see a drive that's, for whatever reason, just doesn't fit in our environment. And every once in a while, we catch one like that where we put it in and I don't know what it is. I don't know if the stars didn't align or right, but the thing starts failing almost as soon as we put it in our systems. And so now you know, skip that one. Don't use that model.
Huh.
But we do test them before we put them in. We had some Toshiba 20s in, for example, and there's even a couple still left just hanging around in there. And they were pretty good, but they weren't, I'll just say, they weren't worth the bump, so to speak, off the 16.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of really smart guys in doing all of that kind of stuff, and I just get to talk to them about it and sound like I know what I'm talking about.
So about this, we've got a question that's come in about rolling up the data. So right now you show the data on the actual model, the SKU, for lack of a better term, of the drive itself, so that, you know, we're buying this part from WD, 22 terabytes, we can track that. Do you ever consider rolling together families, or do you see affinity there? If I look at the new whatever it is, 22 or 24 terabyte platform, like the Exos X24 there, when they launch that family, they'll do new versions of higher capacity drives in that same family. So you might have, you know, 8 or 10 drives, then SED, non, whatever. So maybe you've got 18 or 24 variations of that family. Why not aggregate the family and then maybe even aggregate the brands as part of that communication?
Well, we do aggregate brands. It's fun to do that. The reality is that every drive model seems to have its own personality. It just does. And sometimes you can get a family, to your point, a grouping that kind of looks the same. We saw that way back when we had the HGST 4 terabyte drives. It didn't matter what model we bought or whatever, they all just worked. Okay. But the other thing that changes is model numbers and families, they're not consistent between the manufacturers on how they get advanced.
Sure.
Seagate has, you know, for a given Exos model drive, type of drive, they'll have, you know, 5 or 6 different models. They'll have a 001, 002, and then 1G and 2G and so on and so forth. And those are, they don't behave the same. They don't, in our environment, and knowing what they changed is like secret sauce for them. Sometimes they even change things within a model, like they'll update or they'll rev the firmware and things of that nature. Whereas, you know, some of the other manufacturers never change a model number, but there's different iterations inside there. So even within a given model number, just managing that and calling that a group is, you know, okay. But as soon as you step outside of it, the ability to transfer what you learned from the first to the second and the second to the third and so on. Not that easy.
Right.
I saw that. I had a couple of years ago, I was talking with some guys from MIT who had taken all of that data and done a bunch of analysis. And their hope was to be able to do exactly that with some AI-like software to do transference from one model, what they learned from one model to another and so on. And their answer was, they just couldn't get it. They couldn't get comfortable with how that worked. And that's and I've seen that in some of the other papers that have been written using the data as well, where you can do really well predicting a given model,
right?
But trying to make that work someplace else, not so much.
Well, I mean, that'll be an absolute nightmare too with Flash as you try to think about rolling those up. And we'll talk about that a little bit. You guys don't have much Flash conversation on this report, but you know, we've seen, you know, from every vendor, they've got drives that they sell to hyperscalers, which is different than the drive to enterprise. And it might just be a little tweak in the product numbering that's talking about a different firmware or NAND configuration or provisioning or whatnot. So in that case, it gets even more fragmented. So you really focus on a single SKU, which helps you guys stay targeted and focused on the individual drives. So that makes sense. So with all of this data that you put out there, you must have a favorite. Our guy Orion's wanting to know, what is your preferred drive and manufacturer if you're having to buy for your environment today?
I'm going to say something. I generally buy the least expensive one.
Okay.
and the reason is because I'm a backup guy. And so I'm never one drive deep in anything, right?
Sure.
And that's the right answer. If you're buying something that's your one drive deep in, you're rolling the dice. Nobody's 100%.
No, we give that same advice every time, you know, some home labber says, I need a drive for a system or four drives for a QNAP or Synology or whatever. And it's like, at that volume, you could have four great drives where you get a billion hours on, or they could all be dead in the afternoon. I mean, you just don't know, right?
You just don't know. Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is over the last few years, it looks like the DOA rate, you know, arrival rate has gone down for drives, for at least for us.
Yeah.
That seems to be fun. We plotted out, and we've done this a couple of different times. We looked at the life expectancy with the bathtub curve when drives fail. And they used to fail in that wonderful U pattern, right? Where early failure, settle in, sure, late failure. And the front end of that curve has come down a bunch. It's not quite towards the middle, but the front end of the early failures, or infant mortality, if you will, that has come down for all of the manufacturers. Every once in a while is a model that seems to not do that, but in aggregate across all of them, yeah.
Is the wall of failure doing anything in terms of lowering or coming in or out then also?
So the rates seem to, even the rates have gotten better now, over the years, but the length of time it seems to get to when the curve bends back up seems to have pushed out a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I will also say there's some of us in that data, because when we first started out, everything we bought was consumer drives, because we could go to Costco if we had to, and we did.
I want to think about that shopping trip. I could see you and the guys rolling through Costco in your flip-flops and your jam shorts or whatever on a Saturday afternoon with a shopping cart.
Yep.
You're just filling it up with whatever loose part drives they had, and maybe a little bourbon from the back.
A little bourbon in the back. Well, we normally didn't, even back then, normally didn't do it, although I mentioned drive farming much earlier. When all of the normal channels dried up, you couldn't buy a drive through normal channels. This was back in 2011, late 2011, early 2012, right? Okay. That was the only way you could get drives. And we would
get. When you say farming, do you mean shucking, like buying externals and tossing?
Shucking them, yeah.
Okay.
And so we would do exactly that in our flip-flops on a Saturday afternoon, go out and hit all of the Costcos and Best Buys and whatever, and collect them up and bring them back and then turn them over to our guys. And they would put them together, and you'd have a storage unit a few weeks later.
You must have a sick amount of Best Buy rewards points to cash in for Beats headphones or whatever it is you need, right?
I don't think they gave them to us at that point. we actually got a couple of our guys got banned from shopping at Costco and stuff. It was all of these weird little things that happened because, you know, we were taking out of a consumer channel at that point.
I might also have a Best Buy ban. I can't shop there online anymore. So they got salty with us for doing something not too dissimilar from what you were up to at one point in time. Hey, but look, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. And if you're, and it, really, if in any of these scenarios, if they're directing the product to their big customers, even back then, which would have still been the likes of Facebook and early days of AWS or whomever else in the cloud that, that might be dominating with their checkbook, then you got to be dynamic and go fight the way you can fight, right?
Well, that was what we did, and but what the back to the original point though was, we over time we transitioned from consumer drives to enterprise drives, and so consumer drives, interesting, you know, 1, 2, 3 year warranty, kind of depends on when you got them. Enterprise drives typically 5 year warranties, and all a warranty is just a projection by the manufacturer based on failure. It has nothing to do with anything else, right? And so, but it is, when you buy an enterprise drive, you expect it to last 5 years versus something that you expect to last 2 years. Now, that's not always the case. I have some great 8 terabyte consumer drives that are failing a whole lot less than the 8 terabyte, you know, enterprise drives. But let's just say that's the case. And so that
you're back. Yeah, your RMA returns really should be a pretty creative. I'd like to hear about, you've got to have some good stories about some early days of trying to get service on these things or replacements.
So obviously once at that point when we were cracking them out of the case, the warranty was void, right?
You lose that on the shucking, yeah.
Yeah, but I'll use the word shucking. But for the most part, you know, it was fairly straightforward, and we would, it was more appropriate for us to RMA things if they broke early, because again, operationally efficient. I got somebody there, and they can work, and they can, you know, put stuff in a box and send it back. The thing we learned very early on is you don't get a new one back.
Right.
You know, so you just get something that they rebuilt or refurbished or whatever the case may be.
You still get the remaining warranty life though, right? So if you had 2.5 used, you'd still have 2.5 left. Is that how that works?
You do, or you're supposed to. The reality is you don't know what condition that drive is in. Sometimes you'll get them and they'll still have the hours on them. You know, and something will have, you know, hey, look, it has 12,000 hours on it. Oh my God, you know.
you know, hey, look, a classic car has 12,000 miles on it. It's just, it's burning. You should be thankful. You should be paying them for that.
I should be paying them. The bits are well worn. Yeah, they know what to do. Yes. But we've gotten past that. Now, when we get returns like that, sometimes it's credits. Sometimes it just depends on the manufacturer, and we get returns, and they end up going into what I'll call the replacement pool. So they're not used new for new things. They just go in and they're substituting in for something else that's failed.
All right. Well, that makes sense. I still want to, man, I'd like to go on one of those shopping trips with you guys next time you hit Costco. I want to see what that looks like. I know I brought up Flash a little bit. We've got a question from Blaze who wants to dive into that a little bit more. I think you're using Flash, probably some little M.2s for boot. What else, if anything, are you guys using Flash for in your ecosystem? And if so, or if depending on the answer there, why do we not see that show up in this report?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we obviously use SSDs for boot drives, and we've talked about that. Boot drives are a little more than just booting the system. For our case, they record daily data and all kinds of things like that. So they're actually functioning. And reasonable drives, and they come in different form factors. Some are M.2, and some are just the standard ones, the standard 2.5-inch RUS. So it doesn't really matter. A lot of them are just the cheapest thing we could get because, quite frankly, it's not doing something that's going to kill us. If it fails, we just, you know, we'll swap it out and keep moving. So to pay a lot for something like that doesn't make much sense. Where we also use them in several other different types of servers. So as you can imagine, we have data servers, this is where all of this data comes from, right? And the smart stats and all of that kind of good stuff. And then we have a whole group of other servers which help, you know, API servers, restore servers, and so on and so forth. And various different ones of those use SSDs or flash inside of those. The reason you don't see the data for those is because we don't have them instrumented for that to report it out. The amount of data that they spit out and how often we monitor those things, we're of course monitoring and we have everything instrumented and everything like that, but to actually store it is, even though we're a data storage company, it's just too much.
Right.
We could snap it once a day or something like that. The other thing is the operational considerations. Those things are working. And so that whole little process of just writing something to quote unquote disk, and storing it off and everything like that is and putting it somewhere, it gets in the way.
Okay.
I've asked our guys to do it, and they keep telling me they'll get to it.
No, because they're at Costco all day. How are they supposed to get anything done?
That's right.
They're buying rotisserie chickens, bourbon, and hard drives.
There you go. And so we don't have them instrumented for that purpose, for the drive stats, if you will, for doing that. We do have them instrumented for monitoring, which is a daily activity, not a recording of like monthly or annual data or anything like that.
I will tell you. Yeah, I was going to say, do you have any anecdotal experience then with the failures on those drives?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, we burned them out before they fail.
You kill the endurance?
Yeah. That's what catches us first, because a lot of the things I just spoke about are write something, use it, delete it, write something, use it, delete it, in just a continuous thing. So if you think of like a restore server where we're going to build something to hand back to somebody, right? That data is on there for as long as it needs to, only as long as it needs to be. You put everything there, you put it wherever you package it up, you deliver it, and you get rid of it. Because the source is still on the data files. You know, if you're responding to API calls, information comes in, you record it, blah, 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 you log everything, and then you flush it back out and you go on to the next one. And so you're doing how many reads and writes a day, to that thing. So that's what usually catches them first, is they just get to the end of their endurance life cycles. We're not replacing them at a high rate because of anything. We're replacing it because, like I said, they get to the end of their life.
Well, with Intel cutting off Optane, those little M.2s that are still running around, they're real low capacity. I don't know if that would work for you, but the write endurance on those is pretty wild. And to your budgetary constraints, they're relatively inexpensive. Have you played with Optane at all?
I must admit, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't heard of it, but it doesn't mean that there's not some guys in the data center or whatever.
It would be a travesty if you decided now that you like it, because they're gone. So, I mean,
they're gone.
Yeah, you could buy up the inventory, I suppose, but that would be sad. So in your architecture then, do you not have any all flash nodes? Or everything for data is hard drive based?
Everything for data currently is hard drives. We do use flash for the what we call shard stashing, which is the transition between receiving the data and getting it to disk.
Okay.
The data comes in, it gets written to flash, and then it gets pushed down to disk. But that means we can respond back to the end user quicker, that we have the data, ready to go, if it's need be. So, but that's the only place. And that's, like I said, it's transitory for the data. So we have looked at it. We've talked about it, about building it. The truth of the matter is for most of the applications that we serve data for, that's not the bottleneck. If you really want your data, quickly spread around the world, your gaming company or whatever the case may be, you use different services, CDN services,
sure,
whatever the case may be. We can be the origin store. We're fine with that. That's a good model. But Doesn't mean we won't go there. But once again, we want to be operationally efficient. We want to be able to, you know, charge a fair price for the product and move forward. So right now, the most efficient way to do that is just using hard drives.
So further on that, we've got another question about something that we spend a lot of time on, maybe you not so much, with a lot of the new form factors, especially in enterprise flash, the EDSFF form factors, be it E1S, E1L, E3, or even the standard U.2 that we're also accustomed to. The capacities in flash have gone through the roof, and I know, you know, with that you'll gasp at the pricing. But with 61.44 terabytes from Solidigm, for instance, shipping now, which we use a ton, actually the server, the one you guys can probably hear over my shoulder is cranking through something right now full of those drives. But the density is just absolutely enthralling. But maybe mm-hmm. you guys don't have a density challenge. Is that part of the balance with your investment in flash?
Well, it's... density is something right now we can manage with just hard drives and improving, like going from 4s to 16s, for example.
Well, yeah.
You can see it coming from the point of view of not getting 16, but to your point, you know, substantially more mm-hmm. in the same space, in 2.5 inch versus 3.5 inch or whatever the form factor is you're going to use. You can cram it into space. There's a couple of other little things you got to think about, though, is cooling and electricity. And data centers are, you know, being pointed at more and more mm-hmm. For using a whole lot of both, you know, being dirty and being electrical users. You got to balance that out, too. I mean, we have not only a responsibility to hold people's data and all of that. We have a responsibility from a sustainability point of view and from a, you know, and so on. So, you know, could we build one and could we use one and could we fill a whole data center full of one and give, you know, quite frankly, 90%, 95, 99% of our users no better experience because they're never going to use the capability and use X, 3, 4, 5X the amount of electricity. Yeah, I suspect we could, is that the right thing to do?
You would need another tier at that point. You'd have to have customers asking for a faster S3 or something. And maybe even then maybe it's more of a fabric challenge than a pure, you know, storage IO challenge. But the density on flash is pretty wild, right? I mean, you got it, even though it's expensive, even though it may not solve a lot of problems that you guys have currently, 61 terabytes in a drive it's just crazy to think about.
Yep. Yeah. We certainly look at it. We dream about it. We do some math about it. But right now, you know, for our company and what we do, there's plenty of opportunity to do what we do. We like to keep things simple, single tier of storage. Starting to get into multi-tiers is, then all of a sudden you start introducing all of the things that make dealing with the bigger guys complex. Okay. Hey, you need this management software to sit on and decide how often your software, your data is utilized. And so which tier you should put it on. And that's only going to cost you $1 million a year, because we can save you two. We kind of made a mistake and we put this over in this tier and it was supposed to be in that tier. So you're going to owe us another $100,000 for moving it between the different, and it gets to be a pain. It just really does. Now, yeah. I'm not saying that's not a necessity in many companies, but there are many, many, many more out there that don't need that kind of complexity. And that's what we deliver and we're kind of good at it. And I'm not saying we won't ever go down that way and we won't ever invent something like that because it's really, really awesome. But our DNA is keeping it simple.
Well, I mean, when the prices come down on these hammer drives, you must be chomping a little bit at the bit at the idea of dropping 30 straight into your infrastructure with probably no changes as long as they behave as expected. That remains to be seen. Anytime you have a new tech, even though they've been working on it for 2 decades or whatever, a very long time, nothing's proven till it is, right?
Well, we saw the same thing, by the way, with helium. I mean, they worked on helium for 20, 25 years before they finally got it. Same thing with Hammer and Mammer as well. We work with the different vendors. I mean, we have a good working relationship with all of the different manufacturers. With Seagate, you know, we've talked to them about bringing the Hammer technology on board. We actually had it scheduled a couple of times. And then they pulled it back, you know, because they're trying to get it right, too, for all of those reasons. And, you know, maybe they didn't want us writing about it. I don't know.
But probably. I don't know. Should I give my experimental tech to some dude that writes a blog every 4 or every 3 months about the failure?
That's right.
Maybe not.
Maybe not, you know, and no, and so, but, you know, we know that technology is coming. We're certainly looking forward to it. You know, it'll be interesting to see the real pricing points. You know, what's the street price really going to be? What's the manufacturer's price going to be underneath that? What can we get it for? So I don't know if we'll be, you know, we'll have it on day one. We may decide to invest in it on day one, just so we can play with it and see what it's like and beat it up. So as the price comes down, we know what we're getting into.
Right.
That's a, you know, we did that with helium. We went out and we bought a full vault full of helium drives when they were pretty pricey at the time, but we got our feet wet, so to speak.
What's the quantity for a vault? I'm used to a case that has 20. I assume, and I don't want to assume too much, the vault is larger than a box of 20.
Yeah, it's 1,200 drives.
Slightly
and
larger.
And that's a logical collection. There are 20 servers, each with 60 drives right now. And then we stripe what's called a tome. A tome is a drive in each one of those 20 servers. Mm-hmm. So there's 60 tomes in a vault. You can do the math, right? And that's how we store data, striping it across those 20 systems.
Well, so this is interesting because this has come up a couple times in the questions. And by the way, we're getting some awesome questions from YouTube, so you keep pumping those over. Jordan's the question bulldog who's working through them and sharing them with us over here. But when you take a drive like that, there's maybe a legacy concern, and you tell me if it's still legit or not, about people being worried, enterprises, organizations, yourself maybe, being worried about a bunch of drives, 1,200, all from the same production batch. Would you take those and put them into your vault, or would you divvy them up a little bit to try to avoid that sort of cohort risk? How do you view that? Is that still a relevant topic in today's technology?
I'll say it was before. Now what's happening is we don't build our own storage servers anymore. We did way back when. And then we contracted out for it. Now we buy Supermicro, for example. Okay. And we contract in the heart and the drives as well. And so we'll get a mix of a couple of different vendors inside that particular vault, all of those different systems that come in. And one and two, I think over the last several years, the infant failure rate and the general failure rate has gone out. And again, the quality of using enterprise class drives versus consumer drives has probably had something to do with that. So less concerned about that. The other one, of course, is that we monitor this stuff. We pay attention to it on a daily basis. We're looking at the failure rates of things. The chances of, you know, of having a mass failure across all of the drives at the same time are probably infinitesimal. We also do erasure coding across them, and we factor all of that into the durability of the data that's out there. So, for example, on 16 terabyte drives, there are 15 data drives and 5 parity drives. Mm-hmm. And so we can lose 5 drives and still recover anything out of that particular tome of data.
And ideally you're set up, I presume, so that if you get close to that limit, that maybe you can, you know, offline that node and gently, you know, resilver the data or whatever you've got to do, right?
They have a whole protocol they go through, you know, so you fail a drive. Okay, that's good. You fail a second drive. What are we going to do? Well, let's attempt to, for example, clone the two failed drives now. And because cloning is a lot quicker than rebuilding, you know, and so on. We got a third one. Let's drop the thing into read-only mode. So now all it's doing is servicing. It's not writing and so on and so forth. And, you know, if it ever got down to four or five, for example, we'd be working with the companies like DriveSavers and all of those to get data off the drives. And you start to lock things down and try to back up things as quickly as possible. So we've never gotten down to five failed drives in a tome. It's just, you know, statistically, it's a small number, right? It's the infamous 11 nines number, right?
And the 12th nine is a guy, an intern perpetually on staff at Costco, ready to buy drives to
ready to buy drives
refill if necessary. So let's not leave this topic, because I want to make this really clear for the younger audience or any of these SIs that are putting systems together. In your opinion, then, not that you're issuing advice here, but in your opinion, if someone's putting together a 12 drive standard 2U chassis, Supermicro, whatever, going to install TrueNAS or Windows or whatever, and the box of drives shows up from Newegg or CDW, and they're all from the same lot, your concern is where, from 0 to 100 on that?
It's low. It's on the lower end of things. Okay. I just think it is. Again, you'd obviously want to have some level of erasure coding in there, or RAID, whatever you want to call it,
right?
And make sure that's working, and then, you know, if it's truly precious, have it someplace else,
right?
But I do think it's on the low end of things. I'm not gonna, okay. So is it possible that that crate of drives that fell off the back of the truck? And, you know, yeah, okay. But chances are they're not going to work real well when you put them in.
Well, yeah, I mean, the odds of my golden doodle murdering you are very, very low. Maybe not zero, but they're very, very, very low. Especially if you
try taking away a chew toy.
Yeah, well, yeah. Even then, she'd probably just roll over. She's not, doesn't have that bone in her body. So one of the things that we're experimenting a lot with right now is alternative cooling. And that means for us, we've got a little liquid loop that's probably out of frame that we're working on. We just retrofitted a power edge with cold plates. We're talking to, that's a cool IT solution. We're talking to Chilldyne. They've got a negative pressure rig. We're looking at Submer and all these other alternate ways, Isotope, Zutacore. I mean, there's probably a dozen incredible companies out there looking at alternative cooling. And then we're also talking to guys like Eaton about getting an in-rack cooling set up. We've got some portable chillers. We've got all sorts of stuff going on here as we wrestle with thermals. What does it look like in your data centers? Are you guys all air? Are you able to get a little warmer with hard drives? Do you have batteries in the room that make you fight the cooling battle a little bit more? What does that look like for Backblaze?
So there's two things. You can run data center temperatures a little warmer than you might think. And we monitor that, but you can easily run them up to about 80 degrees. And then the second thing is we actually have a whole data center that doesn't use AC.
Okay.
It's a facility out in Stockton. It's run by a company called Nautilus.
Oh, okay. And, yeah, we know them. Wasn't that a collab with Microsoft or something a while ago? Didn't they start that on the water there?
It is. It's on the water. It's okay. on the naval base there.
Yeah.
So we were the first tenant in, and we have a full up one of our data centers there. The only air conditioner in the whole thing is this one little swamp cooler over the central corridor of stairs, because that was required by California for ADA.
But
everything else is, what happens is the water comes down the river. They have a system at the bottom which takes the river water out. They have some magic that occurs to do transfer cooling to cool the water that runs through our systems. And then we have mats on the back that have fans in them, and they blow the air through, or they actually suck the air through. Because what they're doing is they're just keeping an ambient data center temperature. So you run that at, let's pick a number of 78 degrees. You say, okay, that's going to be our mark. And then they make the adjustments as to, you know, how much water comes in, how quickly things get cooled or not cooled, as the case may be. No AC units, no cooling stacks.
Man, we've got a missed opportunity. The Ohio River here is in Cincinnati is like 2.5 miles that way. I could bring a garden hose up here and try to rig that up. I'm going to assign that to the intern tomorrow.
There you go. You got an intern. Yeah, yeah. Just send him on down there. See if they can get yourself 2.5 feet, 2.5 miles.
50-foot of hose and a pump all the way out of the river back up here. So do you guys colo everything, or do you own any of your own data center footprint?
No, we colo everything. At some point in our life, I'm sure we'll get to that point where we start building our own of them. But right now there's ample opportunity to get into other folks to do it. Obviously everything's in a cage and, you know, a locked environment, of course, like a Nautilus, it's a suite. Over in the Amsterdam's a suite and places like that.
The Nautilus, though, there's got to be a guy with a trident standing out front running security. There is not, unfortunately. This is missed opportunity. This is what happens when you give nerds marketing budget. They don't know what to do with it.
That was the first thing I looked for when I showed up there to take a tour. Yeah.
I don't know how you missed that. It's obvious. Carry on.
No, so the facility's great. They've been great to work with, by the way, because, you know, we're all learning a little bit as we go through this, what the kind of capabilities are and everything like that. Because we instrument everything internally, we can tell, if something's getting a little warmer than it should be and make the appropriate adjustments. One of the things that you find out is the different chassis that you have circulate air differently, in their environment. The other thing you find out is location, and not only up and down, but near a wall, near an aisle, whether or not what other servers are in that rack with it. I mean, there were all kinds of things that, you get to understand about your environment when you start to change the parameters like that. And, the estimate right now is it saves about 30% on electricity. Mm-hmm. Which is a pretty substantial amount. And again, no chemicals, no Freon, nothing like that running through the place. So pretty cool.
No, that's a good reminder. I remember when they launched that, gosh, it's probably been 4 or 5 years at this point, maybe even longer, the Neptune place. I'm going to have to dig back in there and check that out again. You gave some guys on YouTube probably a good amount of fear over their own labs and in preparing for failure when you're talking about the benefits of erasure coding or multiple drive failure zones or however you're set up. Have you guys ever lost a whole vault? Is there, and maybe you don't want to talk about it, but there started to get to be some conversation about the crisis level and what that means in your world.
So no, we've never lost a whole vault. We've lost a server.
Sure.
Where a server will come down, but then that's only one of 20, and that's part of the algorithm, right? And that happens all of the time. You got to replace a drive or, your memory board or whatever the case may be. You have to take a server down. You have to bring it back up. The system, the software is built to understand that it was doing something, and now that system needs to catch up a little bit. In order to have the right data on it and all of that, and all of the software is smart enough to do that. So as
we're as we're thinking about resiliency, I'm sure you know Seagate's Core Vault product. They've built a 102 drive chassis that really acts. It does its own internal erasure coding more or less, and it can recover from failed platters and that sort of thing and just reduce the capacity of that drive. Have you looked into any more advanced telemetry like that? And maybe it's not something they would expose to you without buying that product, but it seems to me if someone's going to fail a platter but not fail a drive and soldier on, you guys would be a good candidate for something like that.
Yeah. So there's some things I can't quite say, but yes, we've talked to different manufacturers and tried different things from them as part of just working with them. Mm-hmm. And then the real issue always comes down to, okay, so what would you charge for this? And
wait, you got to pay to run their drive at a lower capacity instead of RMAing it? It seems like, again, yeah, they should be paying you. This is yeah, easy.
And it doesn't quite work. But,
no,
but
those I'm kinds showing up for your next negotiation. Clearly something's going wrong here.
Yeah, well, I'll put you with our new the guy who runs ops.
I'll bring the Trident. Don't worry.
Yeah, he's. But we have, But you really run into, again, you want to use solid, proven technologies. That's what we're up to here. There's no reason to go reinvent the wheel, so to speak. You just need to do it well. Because that's where, again, the price points are for delivering really good, solid technology to people at a price point that's affordable. But we do, like I said, we do get exposed to all of these different things and we get to see them. We tried, when we were looking for different servers, to move from our RED storage pods, which we built for the longest time. We tried a couple of different models, and one of them was, I believe, at least one of the type of, as you talked about, 100 terabyte, 100 drive system from Seagate with a couple of spares built on the back, because mm-hmm. that's the other fun little thing you can do, right? If something starts to go wrong, you start to rebuild on the fly. So you're never out, so you're never really out of sequence,
right?
And you have a couple of spares and all of that. And we tried that in our environment. It was an interesting one. At the time, it wasn't price appropriate for us. But we'll probably come back to it again, because we're always looking for ways of doing things a little more efficiently, getting, so we can manage the cost down.
Well, speaking of efficiency versus cost, we've got a guy, Ty, and wants to know a little bit more about your network fabric. I'm going to guess you're pretty standard 1 gig management, 10 gig fabric, but you tell me, do you benefit from faster fabrics than 10 gig?
Yeah, they run, it kind of depends on where you're going. If you're going between data centers and network internet connects and all of that, you can run 100 gig connections.
Sure.
Multiple ones, actually.
In your 20 system clusters, what does that look like?
That's at minimum 10. Okay. They may be up to 25 these days. I thought they put hundreds in there and then they split them because they have different functions. Some of them are management functions and so on. But they're minimally they're 10. I think the RED storage pods might be still 10.
Okay.
Because they just don't have the capacity to do anything more than that, to be honest, because of the hardware that's inside of them. Those things are, some of them are, she's from 2013, 2012 kind of time frame. So
still
eons ago.
Still cranking though. So a lot of what you guys do is store things for a comparatively very long time. So, for people that might not know you real well, you've got Veeam practice, for instance, NAS backup, PC backup, Mac backup, a lot of backup, a lot of hold my data and hope I don't need it. I'm sure there's plenty more, but that's got to be a big bulk of it. For data like that, where I might send it to you on a scheduled basis or update it or refresh it with you maybe every so often, but it doesn't ever change much. Do you worry about data sitting around? Do you worry about things like bit rot? Or are you guys always balancing, shifting, redoing the erasure coding and moving things around? How does that work in terms of just a warehousing of data standpoint?
It's a good question. We do worry about it, obviously. One of the things we do is we regularly run what we call shard integrity checks.
And okay.
Just a shard is just a chunk of data sitting on one of those drives, and it's been, it's been summed up, and we go and run that again and see if we got it, and if it's the same. And if it's not, then we just go out and say, hey, the rest of you, 19 guys, we're kind of missing something. Let's rebuild this, and that gets rebuilt. And so, and that's the primary mechanism that we use. That we use to keep track of things. The other thing we're finding now, for example, we're migrating data from 4 terabytes as 16s, for example. And as we go through that process, we actually use our own, our normal read and writes. We don't do anything fancy. We're actually grabbing a file. So if, in fact, when we go to get that file, there was something flipped, a bit flipped or whatever, we only need, again, 17, 16, whatever number of pieces to reconstruct it. And we get it back. And then when we write it, it's pristine again. So we constantly are going through and taking a look at, exactly that particular topic. You can rely so much on erasure coding and all of that, but you don't want to be caught short because you didn't bother to pay attention to something like
that. Well, maybe that'll be the answer to my follow-up there, is if it's a 4 terabyte drive in systems that are as large as yours, why not just yank it and chuck it, put a new one in, and let the system rebuild itself? Is it really worth being gentle with that data when you're retiring a drive?
So the only thing with 4 terabyte drives, it's not as bad, but the rebuild time on a drive in a system that's working, it can be days, okay? And the larger the drive, the longer the rebuild time. And so you don't want to have to reduce the performance of your vault, for example, just so you can get your rebuilds done. So you don't want to create more of a problem than you need. The other thing that's important in our system is that all of those drives in that tome have to be the same size, or at least the same logical size.
Okay.
So I can't put a 16 and suddenly start using the data above 4 if everybody else is 4. So it becomes an exercise more in migration than just substitution.
So let's talk about that for a minute too, and I know we're close to our time, but this one's an important one, I think. In this sort of era we're in of digital consumption, for lack of a better word, we're all creating data, everyone's seeing the charts, a billion things, phones, GPS, AI, whatever. We're creating a lot of data, but you're still in a position where you're turning over components, servers, systems, switches, all this stuff, at a time-to-time basis. The industry, I think, could do better in terms of taking working gear and, instead of throwing it into a shredder, doing something else with it so it has another life. Maybe it's less a problem for you guys because you get so much out of these individual devices, but how do you guys think about your responsibility from a just an ecological perspective or some sort of woo-woo green perspective about what we do with all of this hardware at the end, and can any of it be repurposed and see another life in some other way?
It's a really good question. So you'll enjoy this, and just as a little bit of a story. When we first started using building our own servers and all of that, painting them red and all of that, and we finally, those got outdated and we had to move up. And we actually sent out a note to all of our community saying, hey, we're going to give these away. All you have to do is sign up and come pick them up. And it came down to our data center in Sacramento, and we had a line of people. We had people driving from Canada with trucks and stuff. It was, and we had another one where
that's absolutely amazing, because that one right there, to me and to the guys, a lot of guys listening here and that'll check this out later, giving back to the community of people that are out there trying to solve problems, absolutely fantastic. Love that. All right, so the other one.
Yeah, so that's part of the exercise that we went through. Now we're kind of a little too big to do that. We do try to get as much mileage as we can out of the equipment, like we explained. We also do recycling at the end when things finally get to that stage. There's also services now. I can't remember the name of it. That will take that older hardware and then they just kind of reassemble it, and then they put it in a data center themselves and sell time off of it.
Okay.
So it's not the fastest stuff in the world or whatever the case may be, but you're just looking to solve a problem, and you can, and it's affordable. And that's a really nice business that people can work with. The only issue with them, of course, is there's a lot more junk if you will, than they could ever deploy again.
Right.
You know, so the best answer for our perspective is to get as much life out of the things you have. And then when you do have to recycle, try to do that as responsibly as possible. And that's where we are right now. We're still using storage servers, like I said, that we built back in 2013, 2012. Version 3 servers are still in there. You know, using drives that we bought back in 2013.
Hey, look, don't sell yourself short about being too big. I'm sure you guys are big with your 300,000 drives and all, but if it comes up again, we'd be happy to help you make sure that we find homes for that. I'll even station Jordan with his beard and a trident outside of each data center to decommission and make sure an orderly line is formed, and we'll even have them bring you barbecue and maple syrup for the Canadians to make that happen. This is an amazing conversation. I'm really glad we got this in. What are you looking forward to next quarter? So what's, and maybe you don't even chunk it up like this, but I know you're watching those AFRs slowly, really slowly to drip down. But maybe not even, maybe I'll give you the rest of the year. What are you excited about for the rest of 24 in terms of how your business can be impacted?
Well, I really like the fact that we're starting to up the density of things, and I do see the 22s coming in. I hopefully will see something a little larger than that coming down the pipe as well. I'm kind of really looking forward to that. I want to see how the life expectancy of some of the 8s and 12s do, because they're the ones that are going to have to be, around for a little while longer.
Okay.
For all of the reasons we just talked about, doing that. And it's funny, is people ask that question and I say, well, I don't see anything. When I get the data, okay, then
it does what it does.
It does what it does. I can't make it up. We publish the data. I can't make up stuff. You can disagree with my interpretation. Yeah, and people have, but that's okay. That's what this is all about. But that's kind of the overall trends I kind of see as we go forward. I do see the number drifting down a little bit on average, and I am really looking forward to seeing how the 22s and larger size drives do over time, because that's that's where the future is. That's the next 5 years right there. So,
well, yeah, and I think when you look at, even if we just look at back to the consumer pricing, which is the easiest thing to visualize, we're seeing a ton of deals or discounts or good prices per terabyte in that 16 to 20 band. As you say, as that new tech comes out, the 22s, 24s starts to put a little more pressure on the midsection there, and those tend to be pretty good values. So, Look, I know you've hung with us for a long time. We've gone over a little bit, but the one last question that the guys are dying to ask is, you've got a bookshelf behind you. Do you have something good on the bookshelf, a favorite book or a recommendation?
Oh, a lot of them are, John Grisham, Michael Connelly type of stuff.
Perfect. How do you beat that?
I have all of those collected up. I just shelved my copy of the Stephen Hawking one, the one he wrote initially, because I had read it again just a couple of months ago, which I really enjoy reading, because every time I read it, I understand it a little bit more.
See, I feel like that with watching War Games. I watch it over and over and over again, and each time I learn a little something new.
It is fun to go back and watch some of those. I did that with my boys, where we watched War Games, and I think it was Short Circuit and a couple of other goofy ones like that, and they were just so much fun. And
you spend a whole lot of time explaining old technology, unfortunately.
yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I recommend sticking with Fast and the Furious. It's much easier to get along with for automotive enthusiasts and children alike. Similar.
Yeah. All you have to do is just sit there and watch, and just with your mouth going, did they just do that?
Hey, they took a Fiero to space. Okay, what do you want? That's groundbreaking cinema right there.
Yep.
Well, this has been great. Really appreciate the time. For anyone that missed it, we'll have the notes put together on this. We'll have the audio track out, so you can check that out. We'll scrub this up and put it out as well. But until then, Andy, thank you so much for participating. Love it, and can't wait to do this again with you in a couple quarters and see what you learned.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much.